maybe you've gotten the sense that the potential of our practice is to wake us up out of the distorted views of ourselves, the limited views of ourselves. You know, that, and I would say that generally the limited, the most common limited view of ourselves is the version of us that plays in our mind. Because it makes us really small, makes it seem like we came from back there, we're moving through here on our way up there, you know, and on a little path to our eventual demise. And that's no fun. And it's fraught with all the fears that go along with the uncertainty of what's next. So that's the narrative of myself. And what it obscures, what it misses is the full mystery and grandeur of the being that sits here right now, that it's not really possible to put, you know, in real time, not possible to put in the terms of this person who's came from there is going there. And that's more the story of our life, the situation of our life. We're on our way to our end. And it's worthwhile to remember that our body and the experience that we have as our individual story, it won't last. But if we only think of ourselves as in that historical and future sense, we miss the wonder of what we are on what one teacher, Douglas Harding, called on present evidence. On present evidence, we're awake. We are indescribable. We are mysterious. And when I say that, I'm just amazed that we can even be having this conversation. I get into those moments like, wow. And that I have eyes, and that I have ears and nose and tongue, and by wow. And I can, and we have all this resonance or not. And that's amazing. The Tibetans have a word for this, what we often miss. They call it emho. How amazing, how wondrous. And the experience of ourselves in real time, not so easy to put in that box of our life situation, our family of origin stuff. It's much less defined, much bigger in a way, much, you know, limited. Yet we have a place. There's a place for both. Like, I'm very interested in each person's story here. How you came to be who you are, and all the causes and conditions that led you here, and I think that's being able to talk story or share our histories is a beautiful way of connecting. But I'm also interested in just the essence or wonder of your being that doesn't seem to be this. More the universal element of your being, like, wow, human, or earth, air, fire, water, how we came to be that way. And then just the wonder of consciousness itself. And hopefully practice wakes us up a little bit out of just the story to that to that sense of immediacy, and then remove the word immediacy, the sense of now, remove the word now, timeless, or remove the word timeless even, no foothold for our normal conceptual framework, and wow. Do you get a little wow when I talk about this? Yeah. You've heard that expression, be here wow? Ha, 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 ha. brought along my favorite story about waking up out of our story. This is from, boy, I think I got this maybe just before the last time I came here, but at the risk of redundancy, here it is again. So this is from Anthony DeMello, wonderful spiritual teacher. And from his book on awareness, he said, last year on Spanish television, I heard a story about a gentleman who knocked on his son's door in the morning. Jaime, he says, wake up. Jaime answered, I don't want to get up, Papa. The father shouted again, get up, you have to go to school. Jaime said, I don't want to go to school. Why not? Asked his father. Three reasons, said Jaime. First, because it's so dull. Second, the kids tease me. And third, I hate school. And his father said, well, I'm going to give you three reasons why you must go to school. First, because it is your duty. Second, because you're 45 years old. And third, because you're the headmaster. Wake up. So we all, part of the practice is to get real with what we are beyond our school, remembering that we are the headmaster, that those words I shared from Thich Nhat Hanh the first and second night, or first and second day, you who are the richest person on earth, who've been going around begging for a living, stop being the destitute child. Come home. Reclaim your heritage. He doesn't stop there in his poem. He says, and then, you know, give that to this world. Be passionate about it. So it's very similar to how did the rose ever open its heart and give to this world all its beauty? Felt the encouragement of light. So this process of waking up, remembering that we are the headmaster, is a gradual thing, yet it takes no time. You know, we don't want to put conditions on it. We don't want to postpone this at all. So moment by moment, we just keep cutting through that pattern of memory that makes that story of us seem real, and see that in the moment there is just sights, sounds, smells, tastes, sensations, this aliveness. There's no separation. Everything is given that we need. We learn to take care of this, then it seems like the future, present moments take care of themselves, because you're here and you more likely to do the right thing from real-time awareness. So that made me think a little bit about, you know, the light on the rose and your question yesterday about light, like where does light fit in? And I remembered the story about, yesterday I spoke of the most loving thing that you could do in your life is to be wise. And in the Buddha's teaching, that most loving thing would be to realize that that you've been spinning around in that little story, in that little narrow, puny version of yourself that's never quite enough and never has enough and never is enough. And you can wake up out of that. What could be more loving than to wake up? Realize you're the headmaster. And to do that, it's really helpful to see that innocently you've been running from the reality of life. Innocently, in your attempt to be happy, you've been blocking your way to joy, because you haven't really opened to the fact that, and normalized the fact, and seen that it's universal, that life has within it things that are hard to bear. And your way of dealing with it has been to run from it, in a habit of always looking ahead, craving for what's next, craving to become something, craving for everything to stop. You know, the suicidal impulse is just another form of craving, to its extreme of life denying. But it's really the same pattern of mind that's running away from the truth and making truth even hard to live for, and even thinking it actually exists. All in the pursuit of happiness, relief. So the Buddha suggested, as the truth, that yeah, life has within it dukkha, and your prescription to deal with it is to open to it. And then if you don't, you'll end up on that wheel of samsara, of endless craving for more, different. But fortunately, he gave a prescription for that: let go. Most loving thing you can do is learn to let go. As Ajahn Chah put it, do everything with a mind that lets go. If you let go a little, you'll have a little peace. I bet you've never heard that here, have you? If you let go a lot, you'll have a lot of peace. If you let go completely, you'll have complete peace and freedom. Your struggles with the world will come to an end. The world doesn't come to an end. Your reaction to it comes to an end. Your fighting with reality loosens up. And then he continues, and he said, practice letting go. And because there's a cessation, there's an end to this wheel of endless searching, of endless dissatisfaction. There's an end to it, and you need to realize it. And how do we realize it? We walk the path of awakening. Moment by moment, we create out of our own life a path. It's not some cookie-cutter approach that, okay, I'm now going to become a good Buddhist and then do this and do that. I'm going to use the meat of my existence to wake up. Equal opportunity, mindfulness, and loving-kindness, everything. Myself, everyone else, even the politicians are going to be my manure of Bodhi. I'm everything that challenges me to wake up is going to be my medicine. My difficulties, as I think it was Trungpa Rinpoche, the difficulties, or maybe it's common to Tibetan Buddhism, the difficulties become our path. That we make everything into fertilizer of awakening. And so we practice. So that's the most loving thing you can do is become liberated. And that's what happened to the Buddha. His teachings were just a description of what he did. And it just happened and unfolded in his life. And when he was sitting there under the Bodhi tree, I will get back to luminosity in a minute. When he was sitting under the Bodhi tree, having determined that he would not go anymore to find relief, he would not try to reach the end of suffering by going, he said, I won't get up until I've realized a sense of freedom. And he used a lot of the elements of what we used here on the retreat this weekend. He gathered his mind and he sustained it, and he experienced the power of concentration. And he'd already done some concentration practice before and realized that it's really good stuff. It smooths the mind and body. It tends to decondition a little bit our tendency to need things to be excessively stimulating, because the tranquility became really enough, and just very happy, content. But he realized that all that concentration, even though it had all these side benefits, it really wasn't liberation. It was a kind of temporary suppression of the waves of dissatisfaction. I don't know why I find that funny. You know, more dissatisfaction to come, I guess. But anyway, he when he was sitting there, he said, "I'm not getting up until I'm free." But he used a little bit of that concentration, put himself in the neighborhood. But instead of letting the pleasure of concentration overtake his mind, instead he applied it toward studying in the very same way that we have been over this short time, studying the moment-to-moment experience at whatever was entering the different doors of perception. And of course, in his mental door came Mara, you know, enticing him with all these doubts and fears and enticements to go get off his cushion and go do something useful. Did any of you ever think you were being kind of selfish, or there's so much that needs to be done in the world, and here I am, you know, studying my navel? Or but he saw that as just the mind that is seeking, but doesn't seem to be finding anything, just endlessly dissatisfied. But more importantly, as he paid attention to all the six doors of perception, the eyes, the ears, the nose, the tongue, the body, and the mind, what he paid attention to started to reveal some common characteristics or truths. He saw that everything that he was noticing was coming and going all by itself. And even the noticing seemed to be coming and going all by itself. Arising, a kind of moment of knowing, arising and passing with each experience that was being known. So he saw that the kind of selflessness to the whole process of mind and body. And the more he saw that things were coming and going by themselves, and that without any interference, just applying that quality of awareness, things seemed to just self-liberate. They liberated themselves. He saw that there was nobody pulling the levers, running the show. And that's pretty wild. Right? Wasn't it Crosby, Stills, and Nash or something? Who guides this ship? What was that song? So the more he saw that things were just coming and going, couldn't hold on to anything, things were selfless and they were happening all by themselves, his mind just began to just let go a little bit. Stopped trying to make it into somebody, me, mine, make it all about me. He just saw it for what it was. You've heard some of the suttas. In the seen, there's just what's seen. In the heard, just what's heard. In the smell, just what's smelled. Tasted, just what's tasted. In the felt, just what's felt. The cognized, just what's cognized. That's all. No me, no you, no self at all, as Ajahn Chah would say. Just what there is. And so there was a kind of relinquishing of that doer, of the one who it's happening to, and it's all about me, that the story of me began to kind of melt away, and there was just this, the suchness of the experience. You know, the Buddha was called Tathagata, the one who knows suchness, the one who knows just the isness of life directly. But as he sat there, another thing happened. More he noticed, noticing, 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 this kind of unbroken noticing. everything that he was noticing started to, it had the effect, because when you're in the neighborhood of immediacy, I hope this language makes sense, you're somehow plugged in to life. You know, life is, remember, is very vital, so different from our imagination, which is kind of mental. So he began to feel the brightness of attention, until the point where it was no longer, his mind was no longer as interested or captivated by what he was noticing, but he began to be captivated by the light by which he was noticing. His mind began to shine in its clarity, and he began to be aware of being aware. You heard that expression a lot? And he saw that the knowing of whatever that his, the nature of his mind shining in its clarity was untouched by whatever it was noticing. So the knowing of sadness is not sad. The noticing of happy is not happy. The noticing of fear is not fearful. I find that kind of relieving. And later in his teachings, a very often repeated useful teaching is the Buddha saying, luminous, getting back to light, luminous is this mind, brightly shining, and it is colored by the defilements, the tendencies of mind that visit. This, the non-yogi, somebody who doesn't practice, they don't realize this, and so there's no cultivation of their mind. They just get carried along by the stream of events. But then he goes on to chapter 2, or part 2. Luminous is this mind, brightly shining, and it is untouched by the defilements that visit it. This the yogi understands, therefore there's cultivation of the mind. So this metaphor of light is used a lot in the teachings. And it was that light of attention that allowed you, in your own way, and the Buddha in his own way, to see that none of it is self, none of it is me. That there's no place in that stream of knowing and experience where there can be found a solid entity that exists independent of the contingencies of existence, of the causes and conditions that lead things to be the way they are, that everything is by its at its root selfless. Everything, in other words, with the absence of there being independent self-existence apart from things, there is also the absence of there being anything other. So no self, no other. So what that revealed to the Buddha is that everything is dependent, is contingent, dependent on conditions. Everything is dependently arising due to causes, not based on somebody's will or wish. Even though from a distance, from a more gross perspective, we have individual agency and we make our individual choices, but he saw at the depth of our being, we are part of a sea of conditions, sea of circumstance. And he saw through the illusion of self, consequently the illusion of other as well. And with that, seeing through the illusion of self and the illusion of other, there's no longer that sense of isolation. And what that made possible, what it seems to make possible for everyone, as there is a even a momentary thinning of a sense of our separateness, as we feel much more at home in the world, or much more pain when there's pain in the world, much more joy when there's joy being met. So it does open us up to feel in a way that we've gotten in the habit of not. So that realization, so the most loving thing you can do is wake up to that non-separateness, so that you're no longer falling under the illusion of trying to protect and defend and build up and enlighten and fix and become the great one. You're already great. You're already immersed in greatness. As one of my teachers said, you're already neck deep in grace, already immersed in the very thing that you've been searching for. Not one person here exists apart from the flow of life. Not one person here is small. Nobody here is reducible to that, any kind of characterization of insufficient, not enough, should be different than the way you are. Any of you ever have any of those thoughts? A direct realization of truth just blows that out of the water. You are the richest person on earth. But being the richest person on earth, you're also at the effect of this world, of everything. And you may have much more sense of wonder and access to joy, but you also have access to pain. And you care more, and you're willing to resist more, and you're willing to everything. So part of the realization is that you are wondrous and great, but part of the realization is that you as an individual, because you are heir or part of a sea of circumstances outside of your own will and your wish, that you were born through no fault of your own. It's wild. Even think about that. I don't know. Do you find that humorous? I don't know why that's funny to me. Like, here I am. That we are every day being affected by everything. There's nobody that exists independently apart from anyone else. So we are by our very nature, even though we are uniquely individual, there is no place where that stops and the world begins. It is completely moving with, part of, at the effect of, causing the world to be the way it is. And I like the positive view of Advaita teacher Nisargadatta says, the world is the way it is because people are the way they are. And as long as people are the way they are, the world will be the way it is. If we want a peaceful world, we have to have peaceful people. It's not something you can impose on the world. It has to start within each person. So you may not realize you've been practicing radical social action here, but you have. It's no joke. But because we are the illusion of separateness makes us feel like we can be apart from the flow of life. A realization shows us that we cannot be apart from the flow of life. It also shows us, and if we looked at ourselves really carefully, we see how profoundly vulnerable we are. And profoundly vulnerable to illness, to sickness, you know, to old age, to dying, to circumstances, to change of weather, to change of resources, to change of relationships. We are to a body that is not in our control, moods that are not in our control, thoughts that are not in our control. And yet the identity is always in pursuit of trying to get security. And usually choosing as a source of security that which increases our insecurity. We try to get our body to be right. And what does it do? It doesn't cooperate. We try to get our moods stabilized, and you know, meditation helps a lot, but moods are coming and going independently of our wish. We try to get our thoughts quiet, and then the more you try to quiet them, the more they speed up. We try to get where we're going, but time's always running out. And tethering our happiness to the future, and then leaving ourselves with states, constant states of uncertainty, because you don't know how things will turn out, and that increases our anxiety, and then we walk around fearful. So we're so vulnerable to circumstances, to our bodies, to our moods, to our thoughts. And what do we ordinarily do with that? We judge ourselves. We compound it by our reactions of trying harder to get where we're going, or making a case for the prosecution against ourselves, judging ourselves, and then torment ourselves worse by getting caught in the what the Buddha called mana, papancha, spinning out in the comparing mind, conceit, making up that narrative, I'm above, I'm below, I'm equal, always measuring. And that all increases our insecurity. Is anybody here measurable in real time? So that describes somebody who doesn't exist, and that somebody who doesn't exist, that version of ourselves that plays in our mind, that we try to secure, is the Buddha called it Sakkaya Ditti, self-view. And as meditators, we can begin to make that shift from being carried along by all those comparisons and judgments to noticing, oh, there's the judging mind judging, comparing mind comparing. And we can begin to see the engine that drives that, this sense of insecurity. And instead of attacking ourselves for our insecurity, which is just part of being human, the most wise thing that you can do, remember, the most loving thing that you can do is be wise. The most wise thing you can do is be loving. Are all of you aware of RuPaul, famous drag queen? RuPaul said, if you can't love yourself, how in the hell can you love somebody else? Can I get an amen? Love RuPaul. It is the most wise thing that we can do is to regard ourselves with mercy and kindness. And of course, meditation itself, like Dogen Zenji said, that meditation is not a means of enlightenment, it's enlightenment itself. In some ways, meditation itself is not a means of loving kindness, it's loving kindness itself, it's mercy itself, embracing your being with the light of attention. How did the rose ever open its heart and give to this world all its beauty? How can we ever open our heart and give to the world if we're beating ourselves up? So we provide that atmosphere of attention and kindness over and over again. Shouldn't let a single day pass, single hour pass, without some kind of gesture of kindness and mercy toward ourselves, especially if you're prone to feeling insufficient or judging yourself. Anybody here fit that bill? So the most loving thing that you can do is be wise and remember the facts of life. Good rendition of the facts of life and the admonishment from Jennifer Wellwood. She says in her poem, Dakini Speaks, "My friends, let's grow up. Let's stop pretending we don't know the deal here. Or if we truly haven't noticed, let's wake up and notice. Look, everything that can be lost will be lost. It's simple. How could we have missed it for so long? Let's grieve our losses fully, like ripe human beings. But please, let's not be so shocked by them. Let's not act so betrayed as though life had broken her secret promise to us. Impermanence is life's only promise to us, and she keeps it with ruthless impeccability. To a child, she seems cruel, but she is only wild, and her compassion exquisitely precise, brilliantly penetrating, luminous with truth. There's luminous again. She strips away the unreal to show us the real. This is the true ride. Let's give ourselves to it. Let's stop making deals for a safe passage. There isn't one anyway. Cost is too high. We're not children anymore. The true human adult gives everything for what cannot be lost. Let's dance the wild dance of no hope. And then just so the most loving thing is to be wise, to wake up to life and stop fighting it. And the most wise thing is to be loving. And I think I'll punctuate that with a poem by, and I know many of you are aware of this recent loss, a poem by Derek Walcott, who just died a couple days ago. You know who Derek Walcott? Nobel laureate poet from the Caribbean, amazing. His poem called Love After Love. The time will come when with elation you will greet yourself arriving at your own door, in your own mirror, and each will smile at the other's welcome and say, sit here, eat. You will love again the stranger who was yourself. Give wine, give bread, give back your heart to itself, to the stranger who has loved you all your life, whom you ignored for another, who knows you by heart. Take down the love letters from the bookshelf, the photographs, the desperate notes. Peel your own image from the mirror. Sit, feast on your life. So the most wise thing you can do is be loving in the form of kindness and attention and feast on your life. Don't overlook this vital point that you are the richest person on earth. Stop beating yourself up now. So that's the talk part. And then that's really the invitation to meditation, is to awaken wisdom and love. Wake up.